may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes if I don't get lost in my argument. May it please the Court, I'm Wayne Powell, and I represent Kenneth Lawson, who back when, in August of 2004, was 6 years old. This case involves his violent rape when he was attending the Greene County Summer Enrichment Program in Greene County. I think that Your Honors have allowed me to argue three exceptions or assignments in error, but I think they're all really based on the first, which is the standard used by the court below in sustaining the demur. Obviously, this is a de novo proceeding here. And I think it can be best summarized by what this court has said previously, I think in the Glazberg case, that the sufficiency of the facts alleged are more important than the strength of the proof. And I think that reading the transcript below the court, it's very clear that the facts alleged were measured, weighed, if you will, rejected, and the appellant was put to a standard of proof which is not required by a demur or a pleading argument by the trial court. As I indicated, this is the de novo proceeding. All the facts which were pled, and there were many, there were 75 counts or 75 paragraphs alleged regarding Ms. Jenkins, who is the appellee in this case. And I went through it last night. Of course, I'm one of those people at this stage in my career that it's always important to go back to the basics, which is the amended complaint. And I count about 15 to 20 some very specific allegations regarding Ms. Jenkins, who in paragraph 3 was present at the time that all the facts asserted in the amended complaint took place.
Mr. Powell, may I direct your attention to something else at the outset? First of all, you may not change your assignments of error from the petition for appeal to the briefs. And so, remember, don't do that. You have additional language that was added to your assignments of error. I don't think it's fatal, but you're not permitted to do that. Moving on to the other part of this that is concerned to me, both sides apparently agree that the child in question here is a business invitee.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Both sides agree that there was a criminal act by a third party in the case.
Yes, sir.
Both sides and the trial court accepted a reasonable foreseeability standard for judging this demur.
Yes, sir.
After our decision in the BPI case, the Tech case, the Peterson case, is reasonable foreseeability the correct standard for this demur, or is an imminent probability of harm the actual correct standard for trying a case of this nature?
Well, I believe based on the Peterson case, Your Honor, I believe that is the imminent probability of harm is the proper standard at this point. But
so
I don't think.
What do we do with a demur that was decided on the wrong standard that everybody agreed to?
Well, I would say send it back for the trial court to dispose of it as the trial court should, which should be under the correct standard of viewing this with all the facts implied. I think under either standard, whether it's the imminent probability of harm or reasonable foreseeability, I think that the case goes forward to a trial.
Well, the two standards are very different. I mean, reasonable probability of foreseeability, you can have foreseeability of something without an imminence of harm. So it is a different standard.
I understand, Your Honor, but I think that if one views our many allegations regarding the requirement by Ms. Jenkins to separate by age, to take out hair from the school because he had aged out, he was 14, and there was a long history, as recited in our allegations, concerning what is, by any definition, violent criminal behavior. Now, whether he was arrested, charged, detained, he was a dangerous child. And he had been in that program 4 to 5 years. He was allowed to remain in that program. Ms. Jenkins knew him personally. There are specific allegations regarding her writing him up, saying that he was unsustainable, mouthy, wouldn't obey anything. He repeatedly assaulted other children. This is a child who is explosive, dangerous, and I believe at least regarding this whole issue of the demurrer, if we were allowed to proceed to trial, almost all the cases cited by both sides in this case all went to trial. And so we're talking about a case in which my client was never allowed to even prepare a trial. Now, if the trier of fact decides that there was no imminent probability of harm, that's the trier of fact. We never were able to get there.
Your pleadings recite over and over and over again reasonable foreseeability as a standard. And you're suggesting that we should nonetheless, irrespective of your pleadings, amend your pleading and substitute the standard and then decide the question here? Is that your position?
No, Your Honor. What I'm saying is when we prepared the amended complaint and when we argued the demurrer, both sides were using the reasonable foreseeability standard. I'm not suggesting that Your Honor correct or change the pleadings or whatever. That's the standard we both agreed to. However, as it happens in life, the standard of the law, the way the Peterson case came out, further defined and made a bright line, a line in the imminent probability and the reasonable foreseeability, and that's what we're held to if the case is remanded back. But at the time that we all proceeded on this, we both sides proceeded in good faith using the reasonable foreseeability, but still, the facts, I believe that the facts certainly would imply under either standard that the facts that stated and the inferences available, as well as the specific allegations regarding this incident, would survive under either the reasonable foreseeability or the imminent probability standards. But as I said again, this was never allowed. Again, we never were able to go beyond the...
I don't want to take up too much of your time,
but
what I see it in your future. If the demurrer is reversed, based upon your allegations that it was reasonably foreseeable, and that was the standard that everybody agreed to, as a result it became a law of the case, and it goes back, you're going to get met with a demurrer that says that's not the right standard, and you're going to have to either amend your pleadings or presumably lose again.
And I would submit, Your Honor, that that's exactly what I would do. But we were never afforded that opportunity, but we're not arguing that issue, Your Honor. But in any case, I believe that the facts and the inferences suffice to show this child was explosive, had already committed crimes, and was going to commit more, and that's exactly what he did. And that's what we indicate in our pleadings also, obviously, that it was foreseeable based on his long history of yelling, attacking, stealing things. These are all crimes that it was certainly foreseeable, and that clearly Ms. Jenkins was informed by our pleading of what was being alleged and what the claim was. And that, in essence, and essentially, she showed an utter disregard for the safety of this young boy. And that's what the essence of the gross negligence allegation is all about. But I think that, as I said initially, that everything comes around the standard and the way the judge or the court below weighed the evidence, which I believe was an improper standard used. The standard used is to give deference and inference to the facts pleaded. And there were numerous facts pleaded. This was a special relationship, as Your Honor has just indicated.
Mr. Powell, how would the court give deference and inference to the facts pleaded? The facts pleaded, and no doubt about it, this is a horrible case, but the facts pleaded were the young man was incorrigible, he was mouthy, he was this, he was... But nothing... Where in the facts is there that he would graduate from being mouthy, wordy, and the court could infer that he would graduate to sexual assault?
I don't think, with all due respect, Your Honor, I don't think it's the court's below place to infer that level of and we take the Peterson case, for example. One of the reasons that this was reversed was because nobody knew who the shooter was. Nobody knew what was going to happen. It appeared to be a domestic case. It resulted in the largest mass murder in the history of our country. But in this case, he was assaultive. He was dangerous. He was too old for the program. Whether taken singly or together, we should at least have the opportunity to present those facts, to gather those facts, to discover those facts in a pretrial way. The Delk case, for example, which I think was mentioned, I don't think in Peterson, but in other cases. The Doe case, which this court felt there was foreseeability and there was a case that should proceed, although there was knowledge that the patient who assaulted Ms. Dell had inappropriate interactions with people. There was no allegation that he had raped anybody. And I think the same is true here. Inappropriate interactions, what does that mean? Could it mean robbing somebody, taking somebody's clothes or somebody's belongings from their room? Could it mean slapping somebody? Does it mean rape? Nobody knows, Your Honor. I submit that these are all subject to instructions in a properly pleaded case, and that's what would have happened if we'd been able to proceed beyond the demur stage. So I don't think it's, we're talking about degrees of violence. Obviously, I believe that certainly hitting somebody and then making somebody commit oral sex are two different things. However, again, it's the sum and the quantity of things that were done wrong here. There was no design for this bathroom to make sure there was any monitoring. Ms. Jenkins was the one responsible for that. There was nobody there to determine if a counselor ever could even see who went into the bathroom.
Your case is a little better than that.
Sorry?
Your case is a little better than that. I mean, paragraph 16.
I was going
paragraph 16 says that they were aware of a prior incident involving him that was similar to the incidents described in the complaint.
Yes, sir. And
your case is a little better than where you are right now.
I understand. And that's certainly true. There were facts, and there were papers we'd received that had been redacted, and I wasn't going to, since you plead your reputation in these pleadings, I wasn't going to say something that I didn't know to be the fact. So.
Well, it's not quite as good as that. It says upon information and belief. It doesn't say they were aware. It says upon information and belief.
I understand, Your Honor. Well, that's why I'm here. I mean, Your Honors have brought up exactly why I'm here, is that these are all things, obviously you're not a jury, these are all things we should have been able to discover, argue, present to a jury in the Greenville or in the Greene County Court, and we weren't allowed that. Obviously, these are inferences that the court should have looked at. However, there was enough without that. You've got a kid or a young person who was violent, who had a long history of violence, and was well known by Ms. Jenkins, and she did nothing about him. She actually suspended him from the program at one point. Why was he even in the program at age 14? I think that fact alone might be considered by a jury to be gross negligence. However, Your Honor, we were never afforded that opportunity, and that's the reason I stand here today.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Rosalie Fessier from the firm of Timberlake, Smith, Thomas & Moses & Stanton, here from Ms. Jenkins, the appellee and defendant in this case. As I think has been pointed out, because Lawson alleges a business invitee relationship, the degree of foreseeability is the heightened standard of imminent probability of harm, which is clearly absent here in these.
Yeah, but that's not what you based your demur on, and that's not what you argued to the trial court.
That is correct, Your Honor, but this, we are here today on a de novo review, and we would ask the court to apply the proper standard as that standard was articulated in October in the BPI case. But regardless,
we have a body of law that says we can't decide things different than what was presented in demurs.
Well, then I would suggest that it is additional grounds to affirm the trial court's decision, because we have argued alternatively that the reasonable foreseeability standard, even under applying that standard, the court was correct in sustaining the demur. And if this court were to remand the case for proper consideration of the proper standard, presumably if the court found or sustained the demur on a lesser foreseeability standard, it would sustain the demur on the heightened standard of the imminent probability of harm. But even applying the reasonable foreseeability standard, if we look at the AH case, the Rockingham Publishing case, we had a situation where a juvenile was hired as a newspaper publisher, paper delivery, and there was evidence that the publisher knew that there were three prior sexual assaults on juveniles on these paper routes and failed
to
warn.
As I recall, they were in different parts of the city.
Yes.
And they didn't know who the
perpetrator was. They didn't know who it was. They didn't know if it was the same person. That's correct. But the court found that even though the latest one occurred just 4 months before this incident, it wasn't sufficient to impose the duty to warn on the publisher. And so,
we know who it is. We know his past history. We know he's quite old for the program and has not been removed from the program. We know that counselor saw this young child playing with a Barbie doll and doing some things that are inappropriate. and they know that these two people have been seen together. Now, why doesn't that raise at least a reasonable probability that there's something amiss in this relationship here?
Well, in spite of counsel's characterization of this violent history of this child and the characterization of the conclusions reached based upon the combination of events here, if you look at the actual allegations, the only improper interaction seen between these two was the fact that they of the age difference. There's nothing in the allegations that say that the interactions were inappropriate. It's just that Lawson was 6 and Hare was 14.
And they allowed them to be together.
But that doesn't give any insight or reason for a supervisor to think that the 14-year-old is going to take the 6-year-old and sexually assault them in the bathroom. And
my question is, they've seen them together, and they've seen the younger child playing with the Barbie doll. Apparently that's something that started. It wasn't something that he'd been doing all the time, and asking, I believe, somebody else to take the clothes off the Barbie doll. Now I may be misquoting what the allegations were.
The Barbie doll incident, it's not clear as to the time frame of it, but the 6-year-old little boy was observed to be playing with Barbie dolls and then pointing to the girl parts on the Barbie dolls. And so the subordinates felt this to be inappropriate. It is not alleged that Hare was part of that incident. So other than the fact that, independent of the Barbie doll incident, they've seen these two individuals hanging out together, nothing inappropriate about the interaction, and then independently, a subordinate observes one occasion of him pointing to the parts on the Barbie doll, with Hare not being a part of that, and it's not alleged that Jenkins actually knew about that. It's only alleged that by virtue of her role as supervisor, she should have known, or that she ought to have known because she's a supervisor of the program.
Let me ask you this. If Hare had not sexually assaulted the younger child, but had just physically assaulted him, would that have been reasonably foreseeable?
I don't believe so. I mean, in this case, you don't have information that they are sneaking off to the bathroom together. This is not a situation.
No, that wasn't my question. I said, let's assume for a moment that it wasn't a sexual assault, that it was just a physical altercation. Given Hare's past history, would your position be different? Would you agree that that was reasonably foreseeable?
I don't think it would be reasonably foreseeable, but I think it's closer because you've got a nexus between the history of the child and the actual assault that occurred here. But I don't think that it, even under those circumstances, would impose liability here because Ms. Jenkins, who is the supervisor, had no understanding or no knowledge that these children were allowed to go to the bathroom unattended. They alleged that there was negligence involved, that they violated their own internal policies because they put the table in the wrong place and they didn't have direct sight or visual on the bathroom doors. But there's no allegation that she knew that they were going in there unattended and that children were regularly doing that. So not only do we have to, we can't forget that this is a gross negligence claim. And so even if this court were to find that Ms. Jenkins negligently allowed this to happen and somehow should have known because of the fact that of their age difference and this one independent Barbie doll incident that Hare was going to assault Lawson in the bathroom, they have to show also that she made a conscious, deliberate decision in failing to take steps.
Well, she made a conscious, deliberate decision to let him remain in the program despite his history.
Well, if we look at his history, it's just defiance and mouthiness. He got into some physical altercations. He describes a criminal history, but that's not alleged. We're talking about him being defiant. He's put in timeout. He was suspended from the program at one point. But there's nothing in this history, any specifics in this history, that would give her insight or reason to think that he's going to violate this young child in the bathroom. And the mere fact that his birth date passed over into the age of 14, and I would submit to the court that the evidence would show he was properly within the program, but the mere fact that his birth date from 13 to 14, does that make it more reasonable that just because you're 14 you're going to commit a sexual assault? I would submit to the court that that doesn't give the supervisor any insight or any further reason to think that this assault would occur.
You know what's really interesting about your argument? It's a jury argument.
Well,
we're at the demur stage. Although this is a horrible case, it's still notice pleadings for a tort. I mean, your argument's a great argument for a jury. I just don't know that it's one that sustains a demur.
Well, I think because the plaintiff has to allege facts sufficient to show the gross negligence, we simply don't have it. All he has in here, there's no deliberate
decision. But it doesn't have to be, it can be an indifference. It doesn't have to be deliberate, intentional act by the defendant.
Not
at deliberate. To the level of gross negligence.
We've cited to the case of the city of Lynchburg versus Brown, in which the city knew about this broken gate, and his child died as a result of this broken gate. And the court found that because the city was aware of the broken gate and made a deliberate decision not to fix it, that deliberate decision rose to the level of gross negligence. And
well, we've said that that's important, but we haven't said that that's an absolute requirement.
Well, I think in the absence of any knowledge, any contemporaneous, or even recent time of any warning that this type of problem would occur. There's no allegation that this child beat up younger children. There's no allegation that this 14-year-old committed any crimes other than the one at issue. I mean, he argues that, but that's not alleged in the complaint. I quoted in our brief the Cowan case.
Did you base that remark on the introductory language based on information and belief? Is that why you say that? Because what follows that is a crime.
Yes, but, Your Honor, he does not. We take that as a conclusory allegation that is not based in fact. There are no facts to support it other than to say that it's similar.
Well, he doesn't have to have facts to support it at this stage. He'd have to have facts to support it if it's significant when you get to trial. But this paragraph says that Defendant Morris and Jenkins, based on information and belief, Defendant Morris and Jenkins were aware of a prior incident in 2003 involving her, which was similar to the incidents described in this complaint, with a younger attendee of the program who was approximately the same age as Kenneth was at the time the incidents of sexual assault described in the complaint. Now, under notice pleading, what more do they have to allege?
Well, if the prior allegation, if the three incidents in the AH case were insufficient, we submit that this one very vague description of this 2003, which allegedly occurred a year before, is insufficient to establish reasonable foreseeability. And it's not as if, like in the Delk case, the allegation was that the defendants, knowing the propensity of the assailant, knowing the particular vulnerability of the victim, they watched the assailant enter the room and failed to take steps. That was sufficient to establish a failure to protect in that case. And in our case, we don't have this nexus or this knowledge that the opportunity was there. There's no allegation that she was aware that they were allowed to sneak off to the bathroom where this could occur.
But in the Duck case, there was no allegation that the defendant had committed a prior sexual assault.
I believe that's correct. The way that the court recited the facts, and I have not read the underlying complaint in that case, but the court did not rely on that. But because there was some evidence, or there was some allegations in there that there was some question, there were some suspicions, and then he had some propensity for doing bad things to people, but the court found, I think, significant, and what is lacking here is the fact that they observed the assailant enter her room and did nothing. And that's where I think this case differs from that case. And if you look at the AH case, the court, one of the arguments that the plaintiff made was that the publisher created an environment by which a method of doing business that created an environment conducive to assault, and the court rejected that argument. And I think that's what the plaintiff is arguing here, is that there was this environment of laxity, of inattentiveness, lack of enforcement of their internal policies. They weren't watching like they should have. And as a result, this horrible, tragic thing happened. But that is not sufficient to overcome the presumption that a person's not going to be found liable for the criminal acts of a third party. There's this level of foreseeability that has to be alleged, and we would submit that the plaintiff just has not met that here. And likewise, with the gross negligence, I believe that the Cowan case, which we cited in our brief, it was a terrible immunity case, but it defined the define the levels of negligence needed when there was an immunity there. In our case, Ms. Jenkins is a public employee. She's entitled to sovereign immunity. And so in the Cowan case, the court talked about an extreme departure from routine actions. And an extreme departure from routine actions here is, you know, they didn't put the table in the right place, that they didn't, you know, they didn't have the requisite staffing ratios to make sure that the bathrooms weren't monitored. That is, I would submit that that is not an extreme departure from routine functions. At most, that's negligence. And that's not sufficient here to state a cause of action for gross negligence, which is required for this public employee.
But counsel, a reasonable juror may believe that a person who, in a supervisory role who knows about this and knows that a 14-year-old child is going to be going with a 6-year-old child, and the 14-year-old child has been involved in physical altercations, a reasonable juror might think that's gross negligence. Mightn't he or she?
Well, I mean, I would respectfully disagree on that. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Rebuttal?
Briefly, Your Honor. The issue came up of the joining, I think Your Honor asked that question, the mixing or the mingling of the age groups. And in fact, in paragraph 69, I believe, 59 or 69, the routine and the norm that had been established by Jenkins was to separate the age groups. And in fact, every afternoon, when the only male counselor left, she merged those groups. And that's when, as I said in paragraph 22 of our admitted complaint, that's when Ms. Jenkins viewed the children, these two, Hare and Lawson, play together. And that's when the rapes took place. And these are clear allegations in our lawsuit. Again, I'm not going to repeat what my prior argument is. Your Honors have read the brief, and I appreciate your attention. Thank you all.
Thank you. Court, we'll take a short recess.
All rise.